Okay, so tomorrow is when you get all the exciting results from Rebecca about nucleosynthesis. But in order to understand the nucleosynthesis that comes out of accretion disks, you also have to understand the neutrinos. So today's talk is mainly about the neutrinos coming from very fast rotating accretion disks. And so my collaborators are Rebecca and also Jim Kneller. So the basic idea is that if you're in the collapsar model, for example, you wind up with accretion disks around 0.1 to 1 solar masses, and in neutron star mergers, you wind up with disks around 1 to 10 solar masses. So, oh, you want my chair?
Grab a chair.
And it may be that in hypernovae you wind up with disks too. So the idea is, what's really going on in these disks? And so Rebecca's going to say all the beautiful nucleosynthesis you can get from these disks, but what's going on with the neutrinos? So you have stuff in the disk, and it's spiraling around into the black hole, and then a whole bunch of it, possibly up to half, winds up getting accreted before it ever winds up getting pushed out before it ever gets into the black hole. So you have all this outflow for which you'd have nucleosynthesis going on, but actually in the disk here, you have all these neutrinos. So you have stuff going in, and it's being affected by the neutrinos, and then it flies out of the disk, and then all the neutrinos are coming off from the disk and sort of hitting this material from behind and continually changing the composition of the material. So we're not disk people, so in order to get started on this, we need to get temperature, density, and velocity profiles from disk models, and so we've done our work based on the disk models of Papin-Woosley-Fryer and Narayan DiMatteo and Pernia.
So is the wind predominantly outside of where photodisintegration happens? Or is there wind being created everywhere on the disk?
Well, that's a question we don't know the answer to, exactly where the wind comes from, which turns out to be very crucial for nucleosynthesis. But in our studies, we've assumed the wind comes from somewhere inside the place where your photo is integrated.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So are the disk models very different?
There's the Papin-Woosley-Fryer don't include neutrino trapping, and the Narayan DiMatteo and Pernia do. So they are somewhat similar when there's overlap, but if you have a disk that has neutrino trapping, it makes much more sense if it comes from Narayan DiMatteo and Pernia than if it comes from Papin-Woosley-Fryer. And the Papin-Woosley-Fryer calculations are a little bit more detailed, so if you have a disk without trapping, then it makes a little more sense if it comes from them. So it's really hard to exactly answer that question because they're different calculations.
Oh, I guess what I was getting at then is, how much does the temperature, density, velocity profiles differ, and how does that make a difference? Are you going to talk about that later? How much do they differ from model to model, and does that make a difference to your final?
Well, so both these sets of things are analytic, the standard Narayan platform was one of Narayan's.
So you like use a Shakura Sanyaya type?
It's an ADAF model.
Oh.
So
there's also differences in regards to the source of the energy from model to model. It could be accretion energy, it could be spin energy.
Oh. Not for these.
No.
Not for these.
This is all accretion. I know. But also with other models, you can reach those NAV temperatures. So the true temperature distribution of this is not the very small.
Are you going to show the model scale or not?
I didn't have the temperature density distributions. It's going to turn out that probably there are differences from model to model, but it's what's even more different than that is from different rates of accretion.
Yes.
So that's going to give just hugely different results. So we haven't worried yet about what happens if you take different models and try to compare exactly what you get. So neutrinos in the disk. The neutrinos in the disk are mainly being produced by inverse beta decay reactions, so electron capture on proton and positron capture on neutron. And so these are mainly the neutrinos we're talking about that come from inverse beta decay. So they're mainly electron neutrinos and electron antineutrinos. So not at all, nothing to do with these kind of neutrinos that you wind up seeing in kilometer cube detectors that come from the burst, just ordinary inverse beta decay neutrinos of MeV type temperatures. So as I said, they affect the nucleosynthesis. And if you get to a very high accretion rate or spin parameter, the neutrinos actually start to become trapped, not necessarily through the inverse beta decay reactions, but also through reactions like neutrino scattering on nucleon. Okay, so these models that we started with all have YE of a half everywhere. So they have equal neutrons and protons, and they're one-dimensional. And that'll just kill you if you try to do nucleosynthesis on that, because obviously the neutron and proton ratio is not a half. And you'll get really different results if you change the electron fraction. So the first thing we have to do is figure out what the electron fraction in the disk would actually look like. So here's a little mass element that spirals in from the disk. This is not really the edge of the disk. This is only going out to 600 kilometers. And where it's red, so we started with material that had electron fraction of a half, equal neutrons and protons. So where it's red, you have equal neutrons and protons. And then where you see this guy here is where you start to actually get significant. So you have an electron C, and you start to get significant electron capture on proton, makes neutron, and that drives the electron fraction down. So it makes the material more neutron rich, and you can see that with the colors. So it's slowly turning into orange and yellow and then green. You're at about a third, and then you get hot enough, so you also get a positron C, so you get the opposing reaction, positron capture on neutrons. And interestingly, the electron fraction is still diving, but not quite as fast as it was before. So now you're in the blue, you've gotten all the way down to electron fraction about 0.1, you're incredibly neutron rich, and then you can see in the very center of the disk, you actually pop up to yellow again. And this is where the neutrinos have gotten trapped. So now instead of flying, all the rest of the disk, they're just, as soon as they're produced, they're just flying off the disk at you in the picture. But at this point, they actually started to get trapped, which brought the electron fraction up. And a little bit later, the electron antineutrinos got trapped, which then pushed it back down again. So you're winding up, so at some points in the disk, you have electron fraction as low as 0.1. At the edges, you're at a half. And down in here, you have things of more like 0.3 or so. Okay, so what does this trapped region look like? So these disk models we started with are one-dimensional, so you only have stuff in a line coming out from the disk. And what does the surface actually look like, which is important if you want to figure out where all the neutrinos are coming from to calculate the nucleosynthesis. So if you just assume hydrostatic equilibrium, you can sort of build a little profile on top of this one-dimensional model, and you can determine whether the optical depth is two-thirds then and decide where the trapping regions are. So you get this funny kind of almost toroidal shape or donut type shape for the trapped regions of the antineutrinos and the neutrinos. And this is actually a really fast disk. This is about 10 solar masses per second. And we did that because you can see the trapping region best here. Now, unlike, for example, the protoneutron star, which is this nice sphere, you don't have one temperature of neutrino getting emitted all over the surface of the disk. So you have, if you decouple here, you have one. All right, if you decouple here, you have one temperature. If you decouple here, you have one temperature, and so on. There's also some ambiguity about exactly how you decide you want to draw this surface. So here we're actually finding where the optical depth is two-thirds in this direction, because that's primarily the direction that we're interested in for nucleosynthesis. But actually, for example, if you're looking from this direction, you'd have to see where the optical depth is two-thirds going that way, and that would actually change what your surface looks like. So your neutrino surface actually depends on the angle from which you're viewing the disk. Right. So anyway, if you draw the neutrino surface this way, you get electron neutrino temperatures across the emitting region of, say, 4.5 to 2.5, and antineutrino temperatures of 3.6 to 5.1 at the surface of last scattering.
So what happens inside that little hole? So you're saying it's...
That's where the black hole is.
No. So there's the region outlined in the dotted region.
This line?
Yeah. So inside of there, what's happening?
Both antineutrinos and neutrinos are trapped. Out here, only neutrinos are trapped, which is actually really different than any other... This is the only place I know where there's such a huge difference between where the neutrinos are trapped and where the antineutrinos are trapped. Usually it's a much sharper boundary.
Is it drawn to scale line? Is this calculated or sketched?
The height?
These two contours.
Yeah, they're calculated. That's where the optical depth is 2/3. I mean, in the schematic approach, but yeah.
Why isn't the scale height change much once you go optically think to neutrinos?
The scale height is just the scale height that's originally given in the model. It's not self-consistently readjusted. In principle, we should really now go back and, now that we have the new YE and the trapping region, redo the disk model, but we haven't done that. This is all post-processed on top of a disk model. So this is not, and we actually don't use a scale height for anything. We just put it on here to show, just to give a rough idea of scales.
But the commentator is you made this comment to me yesterday, so I'll repeat it. You can tell me if I'm saying it wrong. The neutrino cooling isn't that efficient, so it's not going to cool the disk immensely even where it's untrapped, because it's the emission of neutrinos is not that high. So you were saying 5% of the energy?
Well, not in this disk. It's much. This is 10, and it was 5% in 0.1 solar masses per second, and it's about 20 in 1. And
okay. So
and so this is actually is pretty. This is it pretty efficient. Well, this I'll show you that in a little while. I'll show that 1 solar mass per second. The trap regions are just much smaller. This gives a better idea. Okay, so what can you do once you get all these neutrino fluxes besides calculate nucleosynthesis? Well, you can integrate all over all space and try and figure out how much antineutrino annihilation you're getting. So, for example, if you have 1 solar mass per second, the luminosity that you get, the energy deposition in neutrino antineutrino annihilation, if you integrate over everything, is about 10 to the 50 ergs per second. And it's got an efficiency of about 10 to the minus 3 or so compared to the luminosity you're getting out in neutrinos. And if you do 0.1 solar masses per second, you get 4 times 4 to 10 to the 47 ergs per second. And so doing this more carefully with the exact formula only gives a factor of about 5 or 6 different than what you guys got in the Pop and Wisley Fryer models. And you can actually see where all the energy is getting deposited, though. So if you have, this is the 10 solar, this is the 1 solar mass. This is the 1 solar mass per second. So you have 10 to the 50 ergs you can divide up here, and most of it winds up in this ring, and this is kind of a log scale, so yellow is one order of magnitude lower than red. And if you want the energy deposition that actually comes over the pole here, you can plot that, and this blue line goes with this picture. So there's actually a peak at a little over 10 to the 6 centimeters or so above the pole. I didn't put a picture up of the more slowly accreting disk, but there's not so much of a peak there, and you have a little less total luminosity. That's a log scale directly over the pole.
Well, what do you do for the luminosity from the optically thick regions? I can see the optically thin ones. You know what to do with it.
We assume there's a Fermi-Dirac distribution being emitted off the surface.
Right.
What's the reason, the main reason for the strong drop in luminosity in going from 1 to 1/10 of a solar mass per second?
Well, the neutrinos aren't, it's not, the neutrinos aren't trapped, and the temperature is just lower. Yeah, it's the temperature, basically.
So, wait, are your numbers higher than?
Ours are lower. Okay, you may also be interested in the momentum transfer from neutrino scattering. It's kind of interesting to contemplate, suppose you had nothing else but this neutrino emission, and you stuck a neutron or a proton there, what's going to happen to it? And you can look at the momentum distribution that you would get, say, if you stuck a proton here and you just let all this neutrino flux hit it. It's going to get kicks every time there's a neutrino interaction, and you can see that the arrows actually push you in this direction, which is kind of interesting. And once again, over the pole, you see that you have a peak at around the same place, which is around 10 to the 6 solar masses. So it's the reactions on nucleon that do the most as far as if you're looking at momentum transfer from neutrino scattering.
But sorry, so you've got, these are ME, typically MeV neutrinos?
Yeah, well, average energy 10 MeV, maybe more, 12 so MeV or so.
So if I had electrons up there, wouldn't they get a much larger force?
No, it's actually, this is the electron line down here.
Okay, so
it goes like, I mean, the electron goes like E and the nucleon goes like E squared. And so once you're in at that, it's like, you know, when you take neutrinos from the sun, you always do it neutrino electron scattering. But as soon as you go to supernova, you're tens of MeV and you prefer scattering on nucleons because it's E squared versus E. Okay, you may also, this is your question, what do the neutrinos look like? You may be also interested in what the spectra of the neutrinos look like. And so this is these are the neutrinos peaking at a little over 10 MeV. These are the antineutrinos. As you can see in the solar mass per second case, you have many, many more neutrinos than you do antineutrinos, and that's just because the trap region is much bigger. In the 10 solar mass case, which I showed the trapped regions for before, you get it's more similar looking between the neutrinos and the antineutrinos. This is 0.1 solar masses, and I think this is black hole spin parameter 0, so you don't have any trapping, and you only have small differences in the distribution of the neutrinos and the antineutrinos. But again, they're peaked at a little over 10 MeV or so. You could compare that with the protoneutron star, for example. So this is the protoneutron star over here. So it's not that different if you look at where the energy is peaked for the neutrinos and the antineutrinos. It's the same. It's a little over 10 MeV or so. This is neutrinos and then this is antineutrinos. But what's totally different is that you have this dotted line, which represents the mu tau flux for the protoneutron star. And you can't even see the mu tau flux on this plot here. It's so small. So the temperatures in the disk aren't hot enough unless you go to the really fast accretion rate, like 10 solar masses per second, to be able to produce very much mu tau flux. But otherwise, you're getting really similar looking distributions to what you have in the
protoneutron.
What's the density in the disk? It depends on the model, but it may be at the center around 10 to 11 grams per centimeter cubed. I mean, obviously it varies over the disk.
So the surface area of the disk where you have relatively thick region must be very small.
It is very small.
Because otherwise you can never have these high temperatures without having some extraordinary luminosity.
I mean, yeah, you do get. I mean, you're getting a big luminosity. I don't see.
Well, if it was sort of thick all over, and you put a 10 MeV.
Oh, so then you'd have massive. Surge. Oh yeah, yeah. You'd be seeing zillions of them all the time.
Does this mean that supernova from 1987A could also have been a black hole?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So. Before we get there, I just wanna address a little bit more, maybe what you were saying, was what does the surface look like? This is one solar mass per second, and this is the protoneutron star, roughly to scale. I mean, these are roughly to scale. So you have the electron neutrinos and the antineutrinos and the mu tau neutrinos. They're emitted all really close to the surface of the protoneutron star. The spheres are right on top of each other because there's this really steep fall off of temperature and density at the surface of the protoneutron star. Not the case in the disk. This is, before I showed you 10 solar masses per second, this is one solar mass per second. And you can see that it's really pretty different where the place where the antineutrinos are trapped in the place where the neutrinos are trapped. And you can also see in this one solar mass per second, the trapping region is much, much smaller. Okay, so your question is, what about core collapse supernovae? So there are lots of people that have studied how to detect neutrinos from core collapse supernovae. So, you know, these occur every 30 to 50 years. You ought to be able to get out the gravitational binding energy of the core, which is about 3 times 10^53 ergs in neutrinos. And there are detectors online now, SuperK, Camlan, Miniboon, that ought to be able to see the neutrinos from the next core collapse event in the galaxy. And once you get these neutrinos, what you're going to do with them is you're going to go to your core collapse model and say, what does it look like down there in the protoneutron star? So now that we went through this whole discussion, so this is your question, how do you know that these neutrinos that you're seeing are really, in fact, from a disk, from a protoneutron star, and they're not, in fact, coming from a disk? Well, you could say, well, clearly disks are more rare, and dismiss the whole thing out of hand. So we see neutron stars, therefore we must make neutron stars, so why worry about this problem? But if you don't do that, then you could say, well, there are different time scales. So in the protoneutron star, you have so much gravitational binding energy, it takes roughly 10 seconds for the neutrinos to random walk their way out of the protoneutron star. So you have pretty good arguments for what the luminosity profile should look like, and it should start, and it should pretty much decay exponentially. Those arguments are not the same in the case of the disk. We don't necessarily know how long the disk will hang around and whether it's going to be changing and therefore change your neutrino profile, but it's probably unlikely to be the same as a supernova neutrino distribution.
Should it be more than a few seconds at least?
Could what be more than a few seconds?
I mean, like the signal will be lost for much longer, right? From a disk?
No? Well, it depends on how long the disk hangs around. Do you want your disk to hang around for more than 10 seconds?
Doesn't it? I don't know.
Well,
peculiar with these disks. You can even have disks without a contact hook in the sensor. There's an interesting PhD article by Dubes and Shapiro in 2004 on simulating the formation of a disk which cannot collapse because it has too much angular momentum. So actually I think the case of a disk versus a protoneutron star or what have you is or a nucleon star is very indecisive. You just don't know. And I think the light curve that we see in 987A are so sketchy to look at the data you put in a graph that I don't think right now you can decide on either one.
But how long do these disks persist for?
What makes a disk lose sufficient momentum that it can actually collapse? It may be dilution by continuing accretion, or it may be loss of gravitational radiation, or you just don't know.
So
people want them to last as long as the GRB.
Yeah, but in the model,
when
they make this, how long do they last?
As long as they need to explain the data, the occurrence.
I don't think they are. I mean, I don't think are the simulations going out so that you actually see a disk lasting for a long time?
No, no one does it long enough.
Nobody runs it long enough, so we don't really know the answer.
So you can't run a low output.
But how do you get 100 seconds? If it lasts a short time, can you get 100 seconds?
Yeah, that's no. I was talking about 987A.
No, no, but the point is that if you can have them in GRBs, then they must be lasting that long, right?
No, but that has a compact object. So here the question is, prior to the first onslaught.
I don't even have a compact
object. That's right, you just have a disk with a hole in it. That's it.
Okay.
That's That's not the discussion on GRDs. That probably has a black hole in it rather than just a hole in nothing.
Okay.
Well, at the final day, maybe you perform something as a whole, which is also black or not so black.
Bagel memory verse model.
Okay, so the conclusion is that we don't know what the luminosity profile is going to look like because we don't know how long the disk is going to last, and we don't know if it's going to be in steady state for however long it's lasting for. But I think it's still probably true you'd have to do something special to mimic what you would expect to see out of a protoneutron star. Then you might think, oh, wait a minute. There's all this energy coming out in mu taus in the protoneutron star, but hardly any coming out in disks. So this is definitely a different neutral current signal. So the charge current, the spectra look pretty similar in the nu e and the nu mu bar, but in the mu tau, it's totally different. You have nothing or you have something. But sadly, it's not that easy because whatever you start with is not going to be, whatever is emitted is not going to be what you see at the detector because the neutrinos are going to oscillate. And you are going to be in a situation where you start at high density and you go to low density. So, and I'm talking relative to resonance points. So you have to consider matter-enhanced oscillations as opposed to vacuum oscillations. And so even though we have, even without any idea of what the density profile is going to look like, you can make a, you can expect that the neutrinos are going to emerge from this in mass eigenstates, different than the case of vacuum oscillations. So oh, Ray Sawyer isn't here, so he can't complain that I haven't included the idea of background neutrinos. But if you assume that there are no background neutrinos in the, when you solve the matter-enhanced equations, you get two cases for the case of nu e bars. So I'm not going to go through all of how you handle neutrino oscillations, but there is one case in which is called the inverted hierarchy with a large theta 1-3 mixing angle. So we don't know what is the sign of the hierarchy that goes with the atmospheric neutrino problem, which is called the hierarchy problem. If the hierarchy is inverted and the third mass eigenstate is lighter than the first two, that's called the inverted hierarchy. If this angle, which we don't know what it is large, then all the nu e bars transform to nu mu and nu tau, effectively. They actually come out as a mass eigenstate, but that's effectively what happens. They're produced as nu e bars, and they're seen in the detector as nu mu bar and nu tau. If you don't have that situation, you're going to wind up mainly governed by, this was governed by the higher density resonance, you're going to wind up mainly governed by the lower density resonance, and roughly a third of your nu e bars are going to wind up being measured as nu mu bars and nu tau bars when they get to the detector. And that covers a couple different scenarios that will both have this result. So there's these two possibilities. Now, if you look at the protoneutron star, these options are actually going to produce really similar results. So there have been a bunch of papers. People used to think there was a big difference between the spectrum of the nu mu bars and the nu tau bars and the nu e bars, but now it looks like these are fairly similar. So the extent to which these are similar means that whatever you do here is going to produce a very similar result in your detector, at least if you're measuring this charge current reaction for which you get the most counts. Now, if you look at this accretion disk black hole scenario, you get totally different. The same things happen, but the result is really different. In the inverted hierarchy, all your nu e bars went away to nu mu and nu tau. What happened in the supernova is what was a nu e bar became a nu mu bar nu tau, but what was a nu mu nu tau became a nu e, and since they were the same, it didn't really make any difference. Here, you don't have any nu mu and nu tau to start with. So if you transform, if you do a swap, all of a sudden you have no nu e bars. So you completely eliminated, almost, the signal altogether. And in here, you still have a pretty big signal. It's just about two-thirds of what it would have been if neutrinos didn't oscillate at all. Okay, so these are plots. They're log plots, so you can't see very well the dependence on angle. So we plotted versus viewing angle, whereas zero would be looking.
Sorry, can I just ask, where does the conversion take place?
Oh, the first.
You just run this through the star.
I didn't run it. We didn't run it through the star. We just assumed for any possible density profile, these are the two things that could happen. But what you would do, if you actually had a profile to run it through the star, is you would figure out what the density profile looks like at about 10 to the 3 grams per centimeter cubed. And then this has to be adiabatic. If these two things are true, then you also have to have an adiabatic resonance here for the Nui bars. I didn't really explain that, but and then if the density profile is too steep, then this doesn't happen and you go here. In this case, it doesn't matter so much what the density profile is. You get a very similar result.
But say again, you know the density. You're saying the density after transitions
is about, this one is about 10 to the 3, this one about 10 to the 2. It depends. It moves with the energy of the neutrino, so I can't give an exact number. But
I would think, so it would matter probably if you have hydrogen or helium, or if you're a totally stripped star, I would think.
Well, if you're a totally stripped star, you still have to go from high density to low density, so then you do it really fast.
You're saying what matters is what's the scale height at that density.
Exactly,
right?
Yes.
I would say that could really be different for a stripped star versus a...
Right, but that's only going to toggle you between these two options.
Right.
Yeah, but
so compact star versus
a guessing.
And you already don't. I mean, yes, you do want to know that, but you already don't know what all these other parameters are. So you're still kind of stuck with these two options, even if you know exactly what the density profile looks like. Yeah, but you know, we could measure. Why not measuring these two things before we see the signal from the next galactic supernova, which would be very helpful. Okay, so these are count rates. I was starting to say this is a log scale, so you can't really see the viewing angle dependence, but zero would be like looking straight down where the burst would come from, and then 90 degrees would be looking sort of side on at the accretion disk. So this is the protoneutron star number of counts that you get in the two scenarios. This is one student oscillation scenario. This is another. And you see, you know, this number 8,000 counts that everybody talks about, and which is a little more if you have this inverted hierarchy, adiabatic one, theta 1-3 resonance, because you mix in, your mu tau is a little bit higher energy. So you have tons of counts. Now, what happens if you have m dot of 1? You're still getting thousands of counts. Not quite as many as in the protoneutron star. All these objects, by the way, were put at 10 kiloparsecs, just like every supernova that will ever explode in the galaxy is at 10 kiloparsecs. And so you're still getting thousands of counts, although it declines a little as you change your viewing angle. If you're at m dot of 0.1, you're still over 1,000 counts. This is a lot of counts that you're getting from these accretion disks. If you go to 0.01, which is a disk I haven't shown yet, where the neutrinos are not trapped at all, you're still getting 20, 30, over 50 counts from this disk. So you're still seeing a neutrino signal, even for, well, at least for the gamma ray burst problem, what is a fairly slowly accreting disk. If instead you have that other oscillation scenario, adiabatic theta 1-3 inverted hierarchy, you wipe out your counts. So you're way down here, you're still getting tens of counts for 1 and 0.01, but you're down to maybe 2 counts or 3 counts for the 0.01 scenario. And that's just because everything that was a Nui bar is now in a new mu bar and a new tau bar, and you can't have this charge current reaction. And you have to scale these rates. This all assumes a solar mass of stuff gets processed through the accretion disk. So you have to scale all these rates by how much stuff is going through the disk. So if you have 0.1 solar mass, it's around for 0.1 solar mass per second. It's got to be around for 10 seconds to get a solar mass. If it's 1, it has to be around for 1 second, and 0.01 has to be around for 100 seconds to get these rates. You can scale them accordingly.
Can you just remind us that for Super K, what
What's the I mean, what's the detection? Is 10 events in 10 seconds detectable? If they don't have any trigger?
If they don't have any, that's.
They don't know anything, and they just get 10 counts in 10 seconds.
This is a question I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that.
You're asking,
I don't
know. Like how many?
No, I just, what's detectable? I just don't have any idea. I mean, 10,000 counts detectable? Yes. Talk about it.
What is it?
What do you mean, 10
not knowing the supernova went off?
Yeah, they don't know the supernova went off.
Would they go, hey,
blind search, right?
Check that out. Something happened.
But the way that, what distance did you think you could take for
10 kiloparsecs.
10 kiloparsecs.
10 kiloparsecs. It depends on the energy resolution, so you would see an ultra-real light curve.
No, I just don't know what their background is.
Okay. Yeah, so I was, yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
For these models, are you assuming a maximally spinning black hole?
I think these models all have zero black hole spin parameter that I showed so far, but we have done models for black hole spin parameter of 0.95.
So how much additional luminosity do you get out from having that additional part of the disk?
I don't know the number, but you get out quite a bit more. So like in 0.1 solar masses, you're not trapped. If you have zero black hole and all of a sudden you become trapped, you have a trapped region. So I'd have to look in our papers to get the exact number for you.
So you could actually raise these quite a bit.
You could raise them. You can't go from here to here, but you could. I mean, you can't jump up a whole order of magnitude in accretion rate by increasing the spin, black hole spin parameter, but you can increase it quite a bit, yeah. Okay, so that's nice, but if you get 3 or 10 counts in your detector, how do you know that that's not from a really far away supernova, considering that you're probably, not, if you see the neutrinos, you're not actually likely to be able to see the light, too. So you could imagine that, well, what you should really be doing is trying to figure out what is the ratio of neutral current to charge current flux, because everything contributes to a neutral current signal, whereas only the Nui bars contribute to a charge current signal, or the Nui's if you're going in the other direction. So, as you can imagine from this discussion, that if you look at the ratio of the fluxes in a protoneutron star, no matter how the neutrinos oscillate, it really doesn't make such a big difference as far as the ratio of the fluxes. Now, if you have more slowly accreting disks, you don't have the new mu and the new tau bars to contribute the original, what was originally emitted as new mu and new tau, or new mu bar and new tau bar, and so this ratio is down by a factor of 2. Okay, as the neutrinos start to become trapped, the ratio pops up again, and it probably levels off at somewhere around this number as you go even higher. If you have the other oscillation scenario, then you get numbers like 40 to 1, 70 to 1, 1600 to 1 for your oscillation scenario. So if you can, in fact, detect, if you have this oscillation scenario, and you can, in fact, detect neutral current events and compare them with the charge current events, if you can actually detect those 10 events in the charge current, then that's a pretty good signal that this is an accretion disk and not a protoneutron star. In principle, this is a really good test, too. If you look at 3 to 1 versus 7 to 1, of course, you get sort of in a murky region as you start to get seriously trapped here comparing with the protoneutron star. But if you can distinguish a factor of 2 in neutrino flux between the neutral current and the charge current, then you pretty much know you're not looking at a protoneutron star, you're looking at an accretion disk surrounding a black hole. And in fact, I mean, this is the kind of measurement they did for the solar neutrinos at SNOW. So they looked at the charge current flux and they looked at the neutral current flux and they said, look, these things don't match, and that's how we know there's neutrino oscillations. The way you'd measure the neutral current signal in Super K is you look at neutrino scattering on oxygen, pops you up into some sort of resonance state in oxygen, and you wind up decaying by emission of a neutron or a proton. And then these guys decay by characteristic emission of gamma rays. So this number used to be up more around 300, but now that the energies emitted by the protoneutron star of the neutrinos have sort of come down in the calculations, you're only in the range of 30 events. These are switched. This one should be 17 and this should be 3. But you're in the range of under 20 events, depending on what your accretion disk black hole scenario is. And which is already not that great, but this result, unlike the protoneutrons, unlike the reaction I showed you before, where you can actually get a nice spectral information, you actually get the energies of electrons, which tracks very well the energy of the incoming neutrinos. This result doesn't give you any spectral information. It's highly sensitive to the high energy tail of the spectrum. So if you don't quite know your spectra, then you're going to change this number quite a bit. So it's not the best to be using to infer the actual energy flux coming from the protoneutron star.
Can you just run by the numbers there again? I'm not sure I understand you. So the 0.14 mass per second scenario, the answer is 3.
Yeah, I'm sorry. These are switched. This should be 3 events times the amount of stuff in the accretion disk over solar mass, and this should be 17 for the one solar mass. Oh. So there's two different mistakes on this page. Yeah. So this is 0.01. It's 0.3. Right. So, yeah, that only made it, that didn't make it any better. The other ways you might want to detect the neutral current signal, it's possible that you could detect the recoil of a proton through elastic scattering at CAMLAN, neutrino on proton. In the PNS, this gives you about 100 events above a threshold, if your threshold is about 200 keV. That's something that's already online that you may or may not be able to see down to that threshold if a supernova occurs. There are proposed lead detectors that would be really much better, that would give you many more events. These are, again, sensitive to the high threshold, so you really have to take a measurement like this together. If you're going to have a high threshold measurement, you need at least 2 of them, because otherwise you change a little bit of your flux, and then you change you change the tail of your spectrum a little bit, and it looks like you have a completely different energy flux. So it's not good for inferring the ratio unless you have more than one of them with different thresholds. SNOW would have been the best thing, because that's a neutrino interaction on deuterium. If you could get both a charge current and the neutral current this way, and it would be a low threshold, so you wouldn't be plagued by these low threshold problems. You could try to do a little better than this, because you can infer the shape of the spectrum from the super K measurement. You could try and infer the shape of the spectrum from a charge current measurement like this, if you could detect the electron. So that's another option, but these are things that are just proposed and not online now. And again, it would be better if you had something like the heavy water detector.
What does the branching ratio between these last two reactions?
You mean in astrophysics or nuclear physics type terms? Oh, well, there's two different resonances. There's the Gamow-Teller resonance, and then there's the first forbidden resonance. And if you go to one, you get one. You're above the one neutron threshold, and if you go to the other, you're above the two neutron threshold. And as such, this one is better than the action, because you actually have. You have both of these options here, and so you get a little bit more information. You have a good idea of where the electron has got, where the neutrino put the nucleus when you measure either 2 or 1 neutrons. And so that's not quite as good as an exact Q, because there'll be a spread of states, but it's sort of like getting a Q value. So. Anyway, how rare is rare? Yeah, I thought of one more slide before the conclusion. How often can you form rapidly accreting disks? Well, we don't really know that these are used for gamma ray bursts, so the lower limit is really 0. You could say that you expect them at roughly the rate you expect a gamma ray burst, which would give you about 10 to the minus 5 per year in the galaxy. But what is actually the upper limit? I mean, what is a real observational upper limit? Can you do this by looking at the number of black holes you have versus the number of neutron stars? Would that support 10% of these events? Could supernova 1987A, we didn't see any neutral current flux. Could that just be from an accretion disk around a black hole? And so it might be really useful to check the next galactic supernova signal before we fit it to proto-neutron star models and see if it comes from, see if they're coming from an accretion disk or a proto-neutron star. So my conclusions are, neutrinos that are in the disk are interesting for a number of reasons. Possibly you could get the energy from the burst. They're going to determine the nucleosynthesis, as Rebecca will tell you tomorrow. We might detect them and learn something about the disk. And in order to do that, perhaps we could use the trine profile or the neutral current signal to try to tell the difference between that and an ordinary core collapse supernova. So that's it.
Which detectors are up and running for neutrinos these days?
Super K, Camland, Miniboon.
So there's three that would, if there's a galactic supernova, there's three that would have a signal?
As far as I know. And it's really, yeah, the by far the largest signal is going to come from Super K. It's just because it's the biggest detector.
Where is Camland?
Camland is in Japan.
Also Japan.
Yeah, maybe somebody else knows exactly where it's located.
Just to make sure I understand the state of the field, it seemed like there was this trend that people were becoming more and more discouraged at having neutrinos drive the possible jets that we're seeing from the gamma bursts. I guess this research is consistent with that trend, that you're just not getting enough energy out, and these neutrino annihilation is the really power.
Well, somebody who's actually a jet person has to answer that question. I mean, this is, if I look at the slide, it looks like it's kind of hard to get enough energy out, because, where was it? There. Because you can't just, it seems like you can't just take this number unless somehow you're pushing stuff this way, and then that is really the relevant number to take. But I don't do jet simulations, so somebody else has to answer that.
Well, there's another aspect, which is how do you get those very high Lorentz factors? So this would be, this would start off with simply making a very hot plasma, and then just rely on the filaments actually. And Woosley agrees that the Lorentz factor then is not exceptionally high.
Well, it must somehow depend on the density of stuff that you have right here. If you have very low density stuff, then you're depositing really a lot of energy per nucleon or per electron positron. I mean, if I put one neutron there, I'm depositing a whopping lot of energy per neutron.